UN experts condemn Israel for targeting civilians seeking humanitarian aid in Gaza, saying the regime is intentionally starving Palestinian people. Pro-Palestine rights advocacy groups file lawsuit against the Canadian government for allowing companies to export military equipment and technology to Israel. And the Yemeni army targets two American warships in the Red Sea with missiles and drones in response to acts of aggression by the U.S. and the U.K. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. As Israel's genocidal war on Gaza enters its sixth month, more civilians fall victim to regime's ongoing airstrikes on the besieged territory. Now, starting with the north, where an Israeli bombing of the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City has left two Palestinians dead and several injured. Cities witnessed also another attack on Palestinians queuing for aid deliveries, leaving several of them seriously injured. In central Gaza, six civilians, including a journalist working for the Al-Aqsa channel, were killed in Israeli bombardment in Deir al-Balah. Number of journalists killed now since the start of Israel's genocidal war stands at 133. To the south, reports say Israel has cut internet access in large areas of Rafah. Now, the total death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since October 7th has now surpassed 30,600, the majority of them women and children. And our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier on the ground there in the city of Deir al-Balah for an update.
The Israeli airstrikes and attacks continued over the last couple of hours. Let's begin from Khan Yunis city, as the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed more residential buildings, particularly in the eastern part of Khan Yunis city and Abasan neighborhood, the neighborhood that was subjected to heavy bombardments and intense Israeli artillery shelling over the last couple of hours. In the meantime, at least 23 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted over the last couple of hours from the same area, left behind the continuous and the chronic Israeli airstrikes and attacks that reached the residential buildings and houses over that area. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli warplanes targeted at least two residential buildings in a Nusayrat refugee camp over the last couple of hours. Dozens of the Palestinian civilians were reportedly injured, and they were brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here. In addition to that, here in Deir al-Balah city, the Israeli warplanes attacked another group of the Palestinian civilians in the western part of the city. They were also brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, where in Gaza City, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling at the southern parts of the city, particularly, and even Al-Zaytun neighborhood. It was targeted repeatedly and frequently by the Israeli artillery shelling.
UN rights experts accuse Israel of intentionally starving Palestinians in Gaza. They say regime attacks humanitarian convoys and civilians that are seeking such aid. UN experts said Israel has opened fire on humanitarian aid convoys on several occasions, despite the fact those convoys share their coordinates with the regime. The report also mentions Israel is intercepting deliveries at checkpoints, bombing humanitarian convoys, and shooting at civilians that are seeking assistance. On February 29th, Israel fired on crowds of Palestinians at an aid center in Gaza City, leaving 112 people dead and hundreds injured. The experts called on Tel Aviv to end its campaign of starvation and targeting of civilians. Meanwhile, a senior UN official says the international community must flood Gaza with aid in order to avert further loss of life from starvation in the blockaded territory.
Now, when children are starting, as the doctors are telling our colleagues, to die from starvation, that should be an alarm like no other. If not now, when is the time to pull the stops, break the glass, flood Gaza with the aid that it needs? So that is what we need to see happen.
The remarks come as international organizations continue expressing growing concerns over the high levels of malnutrition in Gaza. The WHO says in northern Gaza, 1 in 6 children under the age of 2 are acutely malnourished. UNICEF also warned about extremely high malnutrition rates for children under the age of 5. Meanwhile, the UN Food Agency says it's paused its aid deliveries to the war-torn strip since the 20th of February. The World Food Programme said decisions due to continuous return of its food convoys by the Israeli regime from the north, which is literally on the brink of complete famine. Pro-Palestinian advocacy groups in Canada filed a lawsuit against the government for allowing companies to export military equipment and technology to Israel. Lawsuits have been filed by the Canadian Lawyers for International Human Rights Group and the Palestinian Al-Haq Organization and 4 individuals. It says Canadian law bans the military exports to Israel because there is substantial risk they could be used to violate international law and commit crimes against women and children. Since the start of Israel's genocidal campaign, Canada has authorized at least $21 million worth of new permits for military exports to the regime. The U.S. and the Netherlands are also facing similar lawsuits over Israel's onslaught on Gaza. Last month, the Dutch court ordered the government to block all exports of F-35 fighter jet parts to Tel Aviv. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's launched a new attack against Israeli targets and occupied territories in support of Gazans. The Iraqi Resistance says it targeted the power station at Israel's Haifa airport using drones, adding operation was carried out in response to the Israeli massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children in Gaza. Now, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a number of attacks against Israeli targets. Last week, group launched a drone attack on a chemical facility in Haifa as well. Resistance group has also struck major American military bases in Iraq and Syria amid anger over Washington's support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Meanwhile, the Yemeni army says it's carried out fresh operations against U.S. targets in the Red Sea. In a statement, the Yemeni armed forces say they targeted 2 American warships with drones and missiles. A statement also said attacks were in response to earlier airstrikes by the U.S. and U.K. against Yemen, and also in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemeni forces have targeted over 24 Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war. Asana says operations will continue until the regime stops its onslaught and ends its siege on Palestine.
After days of pause in Yemen's naval operations, the spokesman for the Yemeni army announced the successful targeting of an Israeli ship in the Arabian Sea with multiple missiles. He said that the attack followed the drone and missile strikes against U.S. warships in the Red Sea.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces launched an attack on the Israeli ship MSC Sky sailing in the Arabian Sea with a number of appropriate naval missiles. The missiles hit the vessel in an accurate and direct manner. The operation came only hours after Yemen's armed forces targeted a number of enemy American warships in the Red Sea with a number of ballistic missiles and drones.
Experts say this operation sends a message to the US and UK that Yemen's armed forces are still capable of targeting Israeli-bound vessels in the regional waters. Despite their aggression against Yemen, they believe that the Yemeni army has not used its new weapons yet, which will be another challenge for the Western powers.
Yesterday's operations and the targeting of the Israeli ship and the American warships is a message that the Yemeni armed forces will continue their operations against the enemy. No matter what the Americans do, whether political or military moves, we will continue with our strategic options until the aggression against our brothers in Gaza stops. The Yemeni army will carry out more strikes and still has big surprises for the enemy in the coming days, unless the enemy stops the brutal aggression against Gaza.
On Saturday, the British cargo ship Ruby Mar, which had been targeted by the Yemeni army last month, sank in the Red Sea. The sinking of the Ruby Mar has raised concerns about the potential ecological damage to the Red Sea and its coral reefs, as it was carrying more than 41 tons of fertilizer and had leaked oil for several days after the attack. Yemeni officials hold the US and UK fully responsible for any pollution resulting from the sinking of the British ship. They assert that Washington is the one militarizing the Red Sea, supporting the Israeli war on Gaza and depriving Palestinians of humanitarian aid, which are the main reasons for Yemeni naval operations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, British politician and lawmaker George Galloway has warned about current state of the United Kingdom, saying country is at a very dangerous time in its history.
I think that we stand at a very dangerous crossroads in our country's affairs, perhaps as dangerous as any since the summer and autumn of 1940-41. And there's no Mr. Churchill in this picture. There's no one, it seems, able to step forward and steady the ship of state and begin to rally, unite our people to face what is a very difficult future. Poverty stalks the land, child poverty in particular.
Galloway made the comments after being sworn in as MP following his by-election victory in Rochdale. He ran a campaign focused on stopping Israel's onslaught on Gaza. The UK's political scene's undergoing profound changes marked by legal disputes and a significant decline in public support for the ruling Conservative Party. A recent Ipsos poll shows support for the Conservatives, who've been in power for more than 14 years, was at just 20% at the beginning of March. And in the UK, government ministers are considering the expansion of the definition of extremism and banning members of parliament from engaging with protest groups, among them pro-Palestine march organizers. Human rights campaigners, though, say the move is an insult to democracy, as Saeed Puriza reports.
The right to speak out, to protest, the very fabric of democratic rights, once again under attack in the UK, as the government updates its definition of extremism and is about to introduce a potential ban on parliamentarians joining protests. Recommendations from the government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, also known as Lord Walney, who is a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, call on leaders of the mainstream political parties to instruct their MPs to employ a zero-tolerance approach to groups that use disruptive tactics or fail to stop, quote, hate on marches. In the crosshairs, climate activist groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who have organized the enormous peaceful mobilizations for Gaza since October last year. Ahead of Walney's recommendations, and after the by-election in Rochdale, Greater Manchester, that handed pro-Palestine campaigner George Galloway a thumping victory, a speech by the Prime Minister vilifying the pro-Palestinian protests demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. Critics say comments like those about peaceful demonstrations are a threat to the long tradition of freedom of protest and expression in the country.
His assertions are totally false. I mean, you know, the claims of an increase in anti-Semitism, of extremism, there is no evidence for that. I mean, this is just pure invention and another indication, frankly, of how weak this government really is. To have a special address to the nation as if there was some sort of state of emergency. Some people that spoke to me thought that we'd declared war on Russia. What it was George Galloway, the leader of the Workers' Party, getting elected as a Member of Parliament. I mean, that should be celebrated, not attacked in that way. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
The new changes are yet to be announced and legislated, but the political temperature is rapidly rising in the UK.
In its 2024 World Report, Human Rights Watch says that the UK government's practices and policies have severely curtailed domestic human rights protections. Others say the country is at risk of turning into a police state masquerading as a democracy. The question now is, how deep will those erosions go? And will the MPs in the building behind me allow them to continue? Saeed Puriza, London.
Iranians mark a National Tree Planting Day. Every year, just before Iranian New Year, millions of people in the country plant trees to promote greenery development and welcome the beginning of spring. Farzaneh Ashudiyun reports from Tehran.
Planting trees is one of the important actions in preserving the natural resources, enriching forests, creating forest parks in order to preserve the environment.
March 5th marks Arbor Day or National Tree Planting Day in Iran. On this day, which is celebrated to promote the development and preservation of greenery across the country, Iranians plant trees or saplings and encourage others to do so. In December, the Iranian government announced the launch of a project to plant 1 billion trees across the country in 4 years' time. According to officials, the project, which can significantly lead to preserving the environment, is in accordance with international treaties. The goals of the 1 billion tree planting project in Iran include revitalizing natural jungles, increasing urban green space, and countering sandstorms, as the country's climate is mainly arid. Planting these trees can also affect the neighboring countries. More than 30 million seedlings and seeds have been planted in the whole country in the last 3 months. In addition, 116 million seedlings have been produced in the public sector and 121 million seedlings in the private sector. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the all compassionate, the all merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, in a couple of episodes, we made you familiar with the views of Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. He said in his speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution has been the most modern revolution of human history and a totally non-violent development. Today, you will be hearing further of his views on the Islamic Revolution and the unmatched personality of the leader of this revolution, Imam Khomeini. We hope you'll enjoy it. Fred Halliday, in one of his interviews on Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, says the legitimacy of Iran's revolution was to create an independent Iran. This country had never been a serious colony. It had rather remained semi-colony, and during the rule of the Shah, it was under the dominance of foreigners. Imam Khomeini brought back Iran's pride. Once he said that, we will rub the nose of colony to the soil. Halliday considers the Iranian people's resistance against bullying countries and despotic rulers, and also in the Eight-Year War, as an example of honor which was created among the Iranian nation and other Islamic nations after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The Irish thinker continues, in the Islamic world, despite hostility with Iran and the issues which were caused by Iraq-Iran war, the clergy gave the sense of honor to people and made them believe that they can defend their culture. They like to remain Muslim and have relation with the past of Iran and the Iranian literature and myths. Towards the end of his interview, Holiday refers to Imam Khomeini's effort to coordinate between different ingredients of the Iranian identity and calls the Islamic Revolution as a symbol of this coordination. In a speech in 1998, Fred Holiday pointed to Imam Khomeini's peerless traits in ruling the hearts and attracting people and said, Ayatollah Khomeini had a magical attraction and a mystic power which drew the people. Now, 20 years after the Iranian Revolution, many Muslims in the world praise Imam Khomeini as an honest man. I remember when he was discharged from hospital at the age of 83, I asked him, "How are you?" He said, "I'm fine, and I thank people who are concerned about me." This was the first time that I was lying on a bed. I think he was the symbol of simple way of living and morals that were very pleasant for people. Irish thinker Fred Holiday, impressed by the political life of Imam Khomeini, considers Islam quiet compliant with democracy and says, you can be a Muslim and free. Let me put forward a special issue on democracy, having elections and political parties. Those who hate Muslims say that Islam cannot be democratic, and some of the Muslim rulers say that this is a Western system and we don't want it. But these don't have anything to do with Islam. In general, I didn't find a contradiction between democracy and human rights with the Islamic culture. For your information, dear listeners, it should be said that what is preached in the West as democracy is 100% opposite what is practiced. A very simple example to show this contradiction is the way the French police and government are behaving with thousands of demonstrators who have taken to the streets of Paris and other cities for hundreds of Saturdays to protest against the undemocratic and anti-democratic laws in the country. This is France, the so-called cradle of democracy. Thus, what Imam Khomeini and his successor, Ayatollah Khamenei, mean by democracy is truly the rule of people and the sample seen in the West for decades. Anyway, Holiday enumerates five factors for occurrence of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. He names them as asymmetric expansion of capitalist economy in Iran, political feebleness of Shah's regime, broad coalition of opposite forces, prominent role of Islam and Imam Khomeini's leadership, and the altering international ground. Holiday believes that before the Islamic Revolution, there were two outstanding theories in explication of occurrence of the four major revolutions in the world, According to the first theory, revolutions, in spite of all domestic issues, are the outcome of external and global conditions such as foreign attack and undermining of the ruling system is the support for revolutions. The second theory maintains that revolutions are the outcome of political, economic, and social structures of countries, and individuals play little role in them. Yet, the Irish professor stresses that the Islamic revolution in Iran nullified these theories. The Iranian Shah, Mohammad Reza, enjoyed the highest scale of support from foreigners, especially his master and closest ally, the United States of America, till the last day of his stay in Iran. On the contrary, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, enjoyed no support from any government or global power whatsoever. However, according to most experts of Islamic studies, such as martyr Ayatollah Mutahhari, what led to the triumph of the Islamic Revolution were three factors, namely people's faith in God, unity of people, and the unmatched leadership of Imam Khomeini. The points to note in the views of Fred Halliday on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini is that he differentiates between this revolution and the political Islam and the extremist and Salafi outlooks of the groups like Taliban and Al-Qaeda. He has found Iran is a country with a very old and deep-rooted culture and history. He maintains that Iran stands very high in the region, from the viewpoint of cultural, historical, political, scientific, and economic power. Halliday castigates those who try to compare Al-Qaeda with the Islamic Revolution and considers it very false. The Irish researcher believed that Al-Qaeda is not an offspring of Islam, nor even the past Arab world. It is rather an extremist violence. He said in a speech, "It is true that the ideology implied in the discourse of the Islamic Revolution and the stances of Imam Khomeini claim universality contrary to Al-Qaeda. The Islamic Republic never intends to invade other nations or murder foreigners. Imam Khomeini has mentioned the universal issues of the revolution to guide nations." Well, dear listeners, on that note, we have to wrap up this episode. Next time, we will continue with the view of another thinker on Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, how about listening to a prophecy from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible heir, Imam Musa Kazim, peace be upon him, when asked by someone whether he was Deqa'im with the truth. I also rise truthfully, but the real Qa'im is he who will remove the enemies of God from earth and will fill it with justice. He shall be my fifth descendant. His absence will be lengthy, during which multitudes will turn away from the faith, while only a few will uphold it.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, practice makes perfect, whether good or bad. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor to be here at your service. We're talking about Islamic lifestyle on A to Z. Now, what's really important on today's program, of course, we're talking about how practice makes perfect. Now, this is something that, you know, we've all heard and we all kind of understand to a certain extent, but we might not understand all of the different aspects that we are talking about here, right? So a lot of times we say something, we don't understand the depth of what we're saying. Now, yes, practice makes perfect. That means that when you continuously repeat an action, eventually that action becomes perfected. But here's another thing. Not only does that action become perfected because the more you practice and the more you try to make it better, the more it becomes better. But another thing here is that, the more you do an action and the more you continuously do, you know, something in order to have it attain perfection, it starts to become a part of you. Now, this is really good if we're talking about it in a positive sense, but it could be very bad if we're talking about it in a negative sense. And that's what we meant by practice makes perfect, whether good or bad. Now, when it's good, so for example, let's talk about it directly in our Islamic lifestyle. You know, we're doing good deeds, we're paying, for example, charity, we are telling the truth, we're being honest in our dealings, we are praying our daily prayers, right, on time, we're fasting in the holy month of Ramadan, when we get a chance, we're fasting in the, you know, in the other months of the year, I don't know, all of these different things that we continue to practice, at least the daily prayers we practice on a daily basis, but the more we do them, the more we repeat them, the more we practice them, the more perfect they become, and they become a very integral part of our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how practice makes perfect, whether good or bad. So we talked about the good aspect of it, that yes, if we are continuously repeating a certain action, a good, righteous action, you know, for example, the five daily prayers, when we are repeating them and we're paying attention to them and we are focusing our attention on them and we're trying to make them better as we move forwards, of course, this will attain a certain level of perfection. Now, we have to keep in mind that it takes practice. As we said, it takes determination. You know, some days are good, as they say, some days are bad, meaning some days we are feeling really well, some days we're not feeling so well. Sometimes we're, you know, faced with a problem sometimes. So there's ups and downs in life is what I guess I'm trying to say. And when it comes to those ups and downs, then that practice and that repetition of the things that we're doing, you know, they also have ups and downs. But the important thing is to always continue to move forward, to always, you know, have a positive outlook and to be continuously striving towards this better goal. Now, the other thing that we want to talk about before we run out of time is the bad aspect, the negative aspect. You know, we have to be very careful that if we continuously repeat a certain action, which is a bad action, whether it's, I don't know, lying or stealing or backbiting or watching bad things or listening to bad things or saying bad things or swearing. I mean, the list goes on and on. But we have to be very careful that we do not end up repeating certain bad actions. Because in this situation, the repetition of bad actions or the repetition of sins, well, it's a tradition from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. They say that the repetition of small sins turns into one really big, greater sin, which of course is very, very troublesome for us both in this world and the next. So we have to be careful to not repeat bad actions, because these bad actions, just like good actions, end up becoming a part of our being, and removing those becomes incredibly difficult, and it will put us in a difficult position both in this life and the hereafter.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. Between optimism and pessimism, the positions of Zionist experts and analysts range regarding the ongoing negotiations to conclude a captives exchange deal. This is while the Hebrew media monitored the interactions regarding the Netanyahu post-war plan and the resignation of the Palestinian government in Ramallah. The enemy media also focused on the operation where Hezbollah missile shoot down the Israeli drone in southern Lebanon. Regarding these issues, I welcome the analyst on Israeli affairs, Mr. Zahir Abu Hamda. Dear Professor, welcome to this program. The Hebrew media has shown great interest in the downing of the Israeli drone and the military and political dimension it carries. And Professor Zahir Abu Hamda, what are the military political messages that this operation conveys? The Israeli occupation understand well its aspects. I mean, shooting down this advanced Hermes 450 drone by a surface-to-air missile from Hezbollah.
Greetings to you. The topic is somewhat complex. In the beginning, we should note the issue of timing, the issue of political repercussions, and the issue of field repercussions, and these are important. Therefore, we begin with the issue that came to mind of many Israeli commentators. This is the Hermes 450, worth $2 million, and the David Sling missile that was intercepted. The surface-to-air missile costs $700,000. The question now is, what is the price of the missile launched by Hezbollah? This huge financial cost has attracted the attention of many. Hezbollah is not a matter of audacity. It is a matter of decision. There is a decision by the resistance. Islam in Lebanon said that the occupation has expanded its aggression, so it will also expand its operations, and there was a blatant attack in Baalbek, eastern Lebanon. As a result, we see that Hezbollah responds, brings down the drones that bombed these places.
I mean, the enemy spoke about the seriousness of this issue.
It is true, and therefore there is also a point that there are assassination attempts or assassination operations carried out by the enemy in Lebanese territory. A strike must be directed against these weapons that carry out assassinations and bombings. And here is the most important question for the Israelis. If Hezbollah possesses the weapons to down their drones, is it also possible that they can shoot down Israel's aircraft and helicopters? This question is also one of the surprises of the war.
We remain on the occupied Palestinian northern front and the confrontations at the border with Hezbollah, where the Zionist Minister of War has returned to his violent stance, threatening Hezbollah to remove it from the border by force. Galant's threats to Hezbollah were responded to by experts and commentators in the Hebrew media who confirmed that the occupation army is unable to defeat Hezbollah and remove it from the borders. Mr. Zahir Abu Hamda, the Israeli occupation is unable to remove Hezbollah from the borders. What does this mean?
The most important thing is what Gallant said, which is the evidence on the issue that if there is a truce in Gaza, it will not cover the southern Lebanon. I think that this is a matter of raising the level of expectations, threats, and intimidation. But it is also important to take into account the Israeli crisis regarding the northern front, because here we can conclude what will happen. The Israelis have a major problem with the issue of settlers. They have more than 80,000 settlers in north who do not want to return and are afraid of returning. This population says, "We will not return until Hezbollah is removed from the borders." They also do not know what it means to remove Hezbollah from the border, meaning the people of the cities and the people of the border villages. How will you remove them? I've heard Nabi Berri once said that removing the Litani River is easier than removing Hezbollah.
So, Professor Zahir Abu Hamda, the Israeli commentator said the future will not be rosy.
There will not be a future as a state and as an entity for Israel. Future is not only rosy, it is hell, God willing. It will be. But the most important thing regarding the tactical issues currently present in southern Lebanon or northern occupied Palestine is what the coming days will be like. Will we be facing a confrontation? Will it be a limited confrontation or an unlimited one? Is it open or will we go to negotiations, and perhaps negotiations will also be in Lebanon's favor, including a withdrawal from the Sheba farms, the Kafar Shuba hills, or other areas?
Regarding the negotiations of the captives exchange deal, the second edition of which took place in Paris, the Hebrew media published some of the conditions that Hamas insisted on, including the withdrawal of the occupation army from the north of the Gaza Strip. In the same context, the Hebrew media mentioned some of the titles that were discussed in the negotiations, including the release of 2,400 Palestinian abductees in exchange for 40 Zionist captives during a six-week truce. Mr. Zahir Abu Hamda, how do you assess what is published in the Hebrew media about the captives exchange deal negotiations? This discrepancy indicates that conditions are sometimes positive and at other times negative.
To some extent, it is misleading and putting pressure on the resistance, but the information means that there is an Israeli withdrawal from the previous retreat in the Paris talks. It is now raising several points, including that the released Palestinian abductees, the majority of whom will be subject to high sentences, should not stay in Palestine and they should be deported abroad. They are not supported to be in Qatar. The resistance has not responded yet. This is one point. The other point, which I think is important, is that there is disagreement about names. The Israelis are currently saying they are withdrawing from densely populated areas. Previously, the phrase was populated areas, meaning any area with residents must be removed from it. There are disagreements over some names and some details, even on the issue of the duration of the truce. Will it be 4 weeks or 6 weeks? Will some of the displaced people return from south to north Gaza? The Israelis also propose some traps and say that those who are underage, that is, women or children under 18 and men over 50, should return. This means he wants to separate families. He says, do not return to the north of the Gaza Strip. This is an essential point for the resistance. The displaced must return to the north. We should pay attention to the conditions of the Gaza Strip, especially the issue of hunger, the issue or disaster of hunger currently occurring in the northern Gaza Strip. I believe that these coming hours will be decisive, especially since there is clear American pressure that does not want there to be any war or fighting in Gaza during the month of Ramadan. This is automatically reflected in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, and there are even Israeli warnings that this month of Ramadan, there will be what I call a flood inside Al-Aqsa, not the Al-Aqsa flood. That is, if there are Israeli measures regarding Al-Aqsa Mosque, the flood will be inside the mosque and not around it first.
Netanyahu is not interested in an exchange deal and wants it to fail for political and personal reasons. So he put forward a demand to deport senior resistance leaders to Qatar. Netanyahu does not understand what the Israelis are saying, that he is the guilty party and that he must bear responsibility. Benjamin Netanyahu does not want an exchange deal for political and personal reasons. What do you think?
Netanyahu has an opinion on the matter, but it is not a decision for him only. There is a war cabinet, there is a war council as well, and he also fears that there is opposition or a veto similar to Ben-Gavir about any deal or even a ceasefire. Because even the conditions of the resistance begin with a ceasefire, then withdrawal, then an exchange, and then things are reversed, meaning we conduct an exchange, and then the issue of a truce ends with an agreement on a ceasefire. He fears a ceasefire agreement because he has not achieved any of the war goals that he had set. Well, his administration will fall, and then there will be elections. Early or not early won't make a difference. And then the extreme or extreme right would lose the elections, and this is what they fear. But in the end, we must know or emphasize this point that most of the Israeli society, with all its sects, support the war and prefer the war to continue. The issue is not the person of Netanyahu or what Netanyahu represents in terms of war ideas, confrontation or continuing confrontation. They also fear this extreme right or those who support it. They fear that Netanyahu at some point may yield to American pressure. He may acquiesce until he stops the war according to conditions that the Israelis, especially the extreme right, do not desire.
The stormy protests in many areas of the regime against the Netanyahu administration continue, and the demands for its overthrow and early elections are escalating, and the demonstrations in Tel Aviv have reached a confrontation and arrest carried out by the occupation police. After the occupation police arrested a number of protesters, the families of the Zionist captives expressed double fear of the police and the demonstrators supporting Netanyahu. And to the Israeli social media that held Netanyahu responsible for everything that happened in the regime after the Operation Al-Aqsa flood, and Zionist activists demanded his immediate dismissal.
Shoval.
An administration brought ruin on us on October 7, and yet they accused the demonstrators.
Shiran.
I do not understand why Netanyahu is returning us to the demonstrations. Let him leave the seat and begin the early elections.
Yair.
We are waiting for the process of saving Israel from Netanyahu, so let him resign now.
Eidu.
It is time to uproot the worst administration in Israel history.
Adel.
Netanyahu cares about his personal interests only and does not want to end the war so as not to give an account.
Ra'ur.
An administration that cannot confront its enemies turns against its own citizens. The Israeli police are more dangerous to Israel than Hamas.
Novu.
Anyone wearing a police uniform must be isolated from society.
Mr. Zahir Abu Hamda, why did the protest demonstrations against the Netanyahu administration turn into confrontations and arrests? And on the other hand, what are the allegations of those who support Netanyahu in the same place, in the context of what you mentioned a moment ago?
It is a clear reflection of the division within Israel. We have a very large majority that supports to some extent the exchange deal, and we have another majority that we might call the population led by Ben-Gavir and Smotrich. Smotrich asks, how many are these captives? 130? 140? Well, we have sacrificed 500 or 600 soldiers in this war, and even 1,000 more Israelis. We may add around 100, but we do not make concessions to the Palestinians. Resistance. This is what Ben-Gavir said. In fact, they know that if they made any concessions, they would have lost the war. Because considering that from the beginning of the negotiations, there was some amount of a resistance, they would say prisoners are exchanged with prisoners only. The captives will not be released except through a captives exchange deal. Most important of all, this division led by him between Ben-Gavir and Smotrich was also reflected in the performance of the police as Minister of Security, and was also reflected in the street. Perhaps we'll see demonstrations again, similar to what happened about the judicial reforms, part part of the Israeli population were against the amendments and other part were supportive. This is a reflection of the internal Israeli division, and this is what we see in the future, and it will also weaken the internal Israeli system.
After Netanyahu presented the cabinet with a document containing post-war plans, talks began in the Hebrew media that this plan would not be implemented with countries that normalize relations. Briefly, dear professor, what are the implications of the link between the day after the war and coordination with countries that normalize relations?
There's a very large original project led by the United States of America. Now it says that there are intentions to establish a Palestinian state or a plan to establish a Palestinian state based on the normalization of Saudi Arabia and some additional Arab countries with Israel in exchange for this crisis ending and ending with the establishment of a state and there being a government that administers the Gaza Strip and administers the West Bank. But Israel completely rejects this. It does not want geographical and democratic unity between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. That is, it completely rejects the establishment of a Palestinian state, and this is what was expressed by the Knesset meeting. This indicates that the American project has failed, and it will always fail. What else will fail? The Israeli plans. Netanyahu's entire plan regarding the Gaza Strip will also fail as long as there is a Palestinian shooting at Israeli soldiers.
The resignation of the Palestinian government in Ramallah, which was covered with great interest by the Hebrew media, was placed in the context of Arab and American pressures within the framework of what the Biden administration called the improved Palestinian Authority. Based on these words, did the resignation of the Ramallah government, Mr. Zahir Abu Hamda, really come within the framework of what Washington wanted for the Palestinian Authority the day after the war?
To some extent, it is President Mahmoud Abbas who tried to anticipate any American and Arab pressure and tried to throw the ball in the American and Israeli court. It was to some extent an idea, perhaps what could be called a Qatari idea, essentially, for the government to resign. Therefore, we will find that the president went to Qatar and met the Emir of Qatar, and then he met Ismail Haniyeh, and we will also find that this also happened in anticipation of what will take place in Moscow in terms of Palestinian discussions. In all matters, this is a step that to some extent may unite the Palestinians, perhaps later, but I think that it would be a difficult task for any future government to be able to manage the Gaza Strip and the West Bank together, considering that there's always a complete Israeli rejection in between. There must be pressure on the Israelis before there can be a Palestinian government.
Is this the first step for what Biden wants for the Palestinian Authority?
No. Look, for example, what is the difference between Shteya and Mohammed Mustafa? Nothing.
Professor Zahir Abu Hamda, analyst of Israeli affairs, thank you for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your good follow-up. Until we meet again, take care.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Despite court ruling, the Zionist regime continued to kill and cause harm in Gaza, blocked aid entry and allowed officials to incite against Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, it has now been more than 1 month since the International Court of Justice, ICJ, delivered an interim ruling calling on the Zionist regime to take measures to prevent acts of genocide in Gaza. The provisional measures were announced on January 26th, weeks after South Africa had taken the Zionist regime to the Hague Base Court over accusation of genocide against Palestinians. The court did not order Israel to hold its military operations in Gaza, one of South Africa's demands. It also did not rule on whether the Zionist regime was committing genocide and will likely not to do so for some time. However, it did rule on several provisional measures voted for by the vast majority of the court's 17 judges. It ordered the Zionist regime to take measures to prevent acts that fall under Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, namely killing members of a particular group, causing serious bodily or mental harm, deliberately bringing about the physical destruction of the group, and imposing measures intended to prevent births. The court also ordered the Zionist regime to enable the provision of urgent humanitarian aid, prevent the destruction of evidence of crimes, and to prevent and punish incitement to commit genocide against Palestinians. In addition, it commanded the Zionist regime to submit a report within a month outlining all measures it had taken to follow the ICJ's orders. Israel submitted the report earlier this week. Over the past month, actions taken by the child killer regime of Israel in Gaza appear to defy several of the provisional measures. Middle East Eye takes a look at this issue. The court instructed the Zionist regime to take all measures to prevent killing Palestinians in Gaza as part of its obligations under the Genocide Convention. However, Palestinian civilians were killed every day in the first 2 weeks following the ICJ ruling, according to an investigation by Air Wars. Between January 27th and February 9th, Air Wars monitored more than 200 incidents of harm. In 190 incidents, civilians were killed or wounded by explosive weapons, while civilians were killed or wounded by live gunfire in 36 accidents. Among those civilians killed were healthcare workers, journalists, people waiting for humanitarian aid, and those sheltering in education centers. In 13 separate incidents, 10 or more civilians were killed. The killing of Palestinian civilians continued beyond the first 2 weeks since the ruling. On February 10th, Hend Rajab, a 5-year-old Palestinian girl, was found dead nearly 2 weeks after she had been trapped in a car with her dead family and surrounded by Israeli regime forces. 3 days later, 67 Palestinians were killed during an Israeli regime assault on Rafah. The attack targeted 14 homes and 3 mosques. And survivors told Middle East Eye they were shot at by Israeli regime quadcopters while sheltering inside displacement tents. On February 14th, the Zionist regime troops reportedly shot dead a Palestinian man after sending him into Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis to warn others to evacuate. A week later, 40 people were killed and more than 100 wounded after what Palestinian officials described as a heinous massacre in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The Zionist regime warplanes hit four homes in the area, killing mostly women and children. On February 29th, at least 115 Palestinians were killed and hundreds more injured after Israeli regime forces opened fire on people waiting to collect food from an aid envoy in Gaza City. The ICJ ruling also ordered the Zionist regime to take all measures to prevent actions that cause bodily or mental harm to Palestinians in Gaza. In addition to Israeli regime attacks, which have killed and wounded, there have been several